Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we explore the phenomenon of history on film, or the presentation of our past, on television and in the cinema. Our guest is Gary Edgerton, and in particular, we'll be looking at the work of Ken Burns. And after that, Paul Buell tells us why we should take comics seriously. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on September 12, 1880, writer, critic, journalist, and social commentator H.L. Mencken was born in Baltimore, Maryland. Mencken began his career in journalism at the age of 19, working at the Baltimore Morning Herald, first as a city reporter, then quickly rising to editor. In 1906, he joined the Baltimore Sun, where he remained for the rest of his professional life. In addition to being one of the most popular journalists of his day, Mencken published several books, including The American Language and Treatise of the Gods, and enough essays and reviews to fill six volumes titled Prejudices. He was noted for his witty and often pungent social criticism, usually aimed at the middle class. Of democracy, he wrote, "Democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it good and hard." H.L. Mencken died in 1956.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the first map to name America as a continent has been put on display by the Library of Congress. It's the only known copy to have survived of the 1,000 printed from separate woodblocks. It was done in 1507 by Martin Walsimuller, and it consists of 12 sheets which put together cover 36 square feet. The name America honors Amerigo Vespucci, the Venetian explorer whose data, gathered from his voyages of 1501-1502, informed Walsimuller in his work. And the discovery was a stroke of luck. The light of the setting sun hit an ancient tomb at just the right angle and revealed hints of worn inscription. Unnoticed for centuries, it commemorates the father of John the Baptist. This is the tomb of Zechariah, martyr, very pious priest, father of John. The inscription does not mean that the father of the biblical figure is actually buried in the 60-foot-high funerary monument at the foot of the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem, but it does give new insight into the local lore surrounding the early figures of the Christian church. Scholars say that the words were probably written several hundred years after Zechariah's death, and after the tomb's construction by Byzantine Christians seeking evidence to substantiate stories told in the Bible. This is Talking History. Is he a trained historian? Does it matter if his documentaries are watched by millions of Americans with a thirst for history? Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University, posed these and other questions concerning the well-known filmmaker by telephone to Gary Edgerton, professor of communication and film studies at Old Dominion University.
The late historian Stephen Ambrose once remarked that more Americans get their history from Ken Burns than from any other source. Over the past 20 years, Ken Burns has indeed become a phenomenon, his miniseries on the Civil War, baseball, and jazz drawing audiences to make most TV producers envious. Envious, too, are most professional historians of his sales of videos, DVDs, and books. There's even a line of Ken Burns jazz CDs. Why does the American public love Ken Burns? And is Ken Burns' history good history? Well, joining us today to examine Ken Burns' distinct vision of history is Dr. Gary Edgerton, Professor of Communication and Film Studies at Old Dominion University. Welcome, Dr. Edgerton.
Glad to be here, Eileen.
let's start with the simplest question. Who is Ken Burns? Is he a trained historian, a professional historian?
Well, you know, when I think of Ken Burns, I really think of, from a professional point of view, I really think of him in three ways. And first and foremost, he's a filmmaker and a storyteller. And when I look at his films, I think that that's most important because the decisions he makes ultimately when he comes down to things, whether in terms of priorities, narrative seems to me to be always his largest priority. And in that way, he is, you know, a filmmaker like any other. At the same time, he's, you know, the way I would describe him more is a popular historian. You know, your question in terms of whether he's a trained historian, he isn't. You know, he had a few history classes as an undergraduate at Hampshire College, but in lots of ways, he is, you know, a self-taught historian. He's a very smart and articulate man, and he has, I think of all the filmmakers I've observed and analyzed, he certainly has more similarities to a scholar than any other. You know, he certainly thoroughly researches his subjects along with his team. He's still very much involved in that, you know, even though he's been at this for 25, 30 years and he has a whole group of people working with him. You know, he's involved in the writing of grant proposals and the analysis that's part of that. And he collaborates and debates with scholarly advisors, and there are more advisors on his bigger miniseries, but he's very much connected with and involved with the academic world. I think there's a lot of heat that is communicated about the conflicts he has from time to time with scholars, but, you know, by and large, he has much more of a cooperative relationship with more scholars if you look at his career as a whole. Third, though, he, you know, and I think this ties into your introduction, he's a television executive and a producer, and he runs a small independent production company, and part of that, too, is, you know, he's in business, and he's in business to, you know, keep his employees in work and him as well, and in that way, you have all the ancillary products that you talked about that are part of his television histories, and it also brings up the important issue, which I think you suggested, the whole idea of commodification of history.
You mentioned that that Ken Burns has been doing television programs for about 25 years, but it was really his Civil War series in 1990 that put him on the map. And why was that series on the Civil War such a television landmark?
Oh, that's a complicated question. I think there's a lot of reasons, but prior to that, just if I could, you know, just preface this with, he really, prior to the Civil War, if you're thinking in terms of filmic circles and also documentary circles, he was very well known. And, you know, I've interviewed him a number of different times, and one of the things he explained to me prior to doing the Civil War, that he really had thought that he had accomplished all he would be able to accomplish in his, you know, in his profession. I mean, he won loads of awards for the six films that came before the Civil War. And then he said, and the Civil War came, and it was almost like he was born again. You know, that what I think happened is not only was his wildest dream realized, but also he changed the parameters and the possibilities for documentary filmmakers in general and historical documentarists in particular. The Civil War, a lot of reasons, I think, why it was popular. You know, there are aesthetic reasons, the technical and dramatic quality of the miniseries. It is 11 hours long, and the narrative, you know, hangs together very tightly. That's difficult to do when you're talking a 90-minute to 120-minute film. When you're talking about 11 hours, it's quite an accomplishment. There are all kinds of institutional reasons when I think about it, and, you know, this may seem a little bit more arcane, you know, more for film studies communication people who study the industry, but the whole idea that it was scheduled, you know, from Sunday through Thursday was actually a gamble that most of the miniseries is that they would have, and they still have now on public television and other cable channels. They usually do it on a weekly basis. But what this allowed was a momentum to be built up, and the audience not only maintained but increased during the week. huge marketing blitz, the amount of marketing that was tied to the Civil War, you know, was unlike anything ever tied to a documentary before. That, you know, 200 copies of the miniseries went out to TV critics beforehand, so it created word of mouth. You know, if the series wasn't good, then critics wouldn't be giving it good reviews, but in a certain sense, audiences were primed because all of these articles were coming out in newspapers. And the ancillary products that you talked about, too, the book, it's, you know, the companion book, sold 800,000 copies within the first year and over a million, and the videotape series afterwards was a million. Ultimately, though, I think the most important reasons, though, are conceptual, historiographic, that what he was doing was, in a sense, reinterpreting the Civil War for a new generation. As a film historian, I look back and see, you know, how seminal some films about the Civil War have been, from The Birth of a Nation in 1915, which really defined it for that particular generation in a much more conservative and racist way than we certainly would look at it from our perspective now in 2003. Gone with the Wind in 1939, and then what you have with the Civil War in 1990 is taking this seminal event in American history and reframing it through the eyes of a baby boomer filmmaker. And in that way, the, you know, the bottom-up approach, which had been well developed in the historical discipline for a generation, was now incorporated into the storytelling that, you know, two common soldiers, Elijah Hunt Rhodes, a Yankee from Rhode Island, and Sam Watkins, a Confederate from Tennessee, you know, we were able to follow them as well as to follow all the, you know, the powerful and famous names that we usually associate with the Civil War. And there were a lot of other common people, too, that in a sense brought the past into the present for such a huge audience. And, you know, scholars try and stay away from or at least be careful with presentism as much as possible. But I think one of the intents of most documentary filmmakers who do history is they really strive for that. They look for those elements that are most relevant in the present in the past events that they are putting on film, and if they're successful in doing that, then they find it, you know, the audiences find it compelling. The Civil War still is the most watched series in public television history. 38.9 million people watched it, you know, that week in September 1990. 70 million Americans now have watched the Civil War. And when you look in terms of, you know, how many people watched documentaries prior to that, you know, this is just unheard of, that what he really did was redefine not only the place of documentaries on American television, but also redefine what is possible with a documentary.
Ken Burns also seemed to redefine the documentary style in terms of filmmaking. How would you describe the Ken Burns style?
Well, in a word, it's a collage. That all of the techniques that he uses have been used before, and in fact, they're pretty traditional, that most of them harken back to the 1940s and 1950s. What his genius is as a filmmaker is he put them together in a seamless way, and, you know, where they might have been used separately in the past. You know, he put four or five different particular techniques together, and there's a certain chemistry to them, to the point where when one thinks about people today, I think, have a hard time remembering when Ken Burns' films came out and Huey Long, you know, made movie theaters. It actually had commercial distribution as well as television in 1986. All of the reviews talked about how fresh and original this style was. But it's become so successful, in fact, he's usually criticized now for repetition, you know, but the point is, it isn't so much his repetition as much as his style has become normative for an entire generation of filmmakers. He's known first and foremost, of course, for what's called the refotographing technique. And, you know, it's still in motion where he looks at photographs and, you know, has a lot of panning and zooming and movement within the photographs. the way this works is if you'll, you know, the next time you may watch one of his films, the live footage he has is always, is almost shot like a still photograph. So the live footage is, you know, very formal and academic, and there's not a lot of movement in there. And then when he moves to the photographs, all of a sudden that's where all the action occurs. But what it does is jumpstart those photographs and really makes them come alive on screen. The skeleton of his technique is an off-screen narration, you know, which is usually telling the particular story and giving the, you know, the details of whatever the particular subject is. Tied into that is what he refers to as his chorus of voices, which is readings from personal papers, diaries, and letters, and, you know, usually has, you know, accomplished performers who are doing that. And when you think about it, you know, people think in terms of recreations and you know, being a fudge for nonfiction filmmakers, something that they shouldn't do. But most of the time they think in terms of it as visual recreations, of having someone, you know, dressed up in a historical garment and playing a particular character. But these chorus of voices off screen have always been recreations. But what it's trying to do is to take these words from, in the case of the Civil War, that are, you know, 150 years old, and trying to make them passionate and energetic and relevant to a contemporary viewer. There are also experts, witnesses, who are interviewed on screen, and in fact a lot of people from the Organization of American Historians or American Historical Association, you know, find their way into films this way. And also, their work gets known by a wider audience because of the audiences that watch some of these films on public television. Probably the coup de grace is the musical accompaniment in the background, which is always important to give an emotional context. And what he uses is period composition and folk music, and, you know, from the time to again, another artifact to bring the time alive. You know, one little anecdote is when he started making films with Brooklyn Bridge back in the late 1970s, he had no choice in terms of the kinds of musical accompaniment he had, that, you know, his budget. Interestingly, the Brooklyn Bridge, which is an hour long, took 5 years to make, almost as long as the Civil War. And the reason is just the difficulty that independent filmmakers have with money and raising money. And what he did for the soundtrack was literally go to flea markets and, you know, find old recordings to get, you know, and it, period music was the easy thing for him to get. On the other hand, which has been a characteristic of his entire career, is taking that limitation and turning it into, you know, one of the strengths of his style. And now, even though he can afford probably any kind of soundtrack that he wants to use, the whole idea of using, you know, period music as a background has become such a part of this signature Ken Burns style. You know, the rephotographing, the narration, the chorus of voices, the witnesses on screen, and also the musical soundtrack.
We only have a few moments left, but historians often complain that too many people today learn their history from going to the movies. Well, I guess the question naturally follows, is watching a Ken Burns series any better than going to a film? I mean, is it a good thing that, as Ambrose said, more Americans get their history from Ken Burns than from any other source?
Yeah. I don't know whether so much I would think of it as better or worse, you know, as much as complimentary. You know, certainly when you deal with Ken Burns, that there and all of the other historic, because we're really talking about a generation of historical filmmakers, you know, what is happening certainly is a shift in emphasis, and it's happening within the culture. You know, the visual media are rising, so in that way people have an interest. I think the mistake some people make is to think of it in terms of either or, and also to think of it in terms that more people get their history from Ken Burns, but what that might imply is they don't get their history from any other place. And I don't think that that's true. That I think it's a good thing, because I think it brings, you know, history might have been more on the margins 20 years ago in terms of just the popular consciousness. You know, more Americans than ever, if you're thinking the last 50 years, are passionately interested in history. Some people just stay on the level of very popular history, and there are certainly more popular expressions of it than Ken Burns, and there are more popular expressions of it on television than Ken Burns, and there are different levels. And I think these popular expressions bring people to, you know, to other ones as well. That one thing that happened with the Civil War series is not only did Ken Burns become very popular, but there was an explosion in, you know, in books about the Civil War in general. And when you look at, you know, with your introduction, you talked about all the ancillary products with Ken Burns. One of the things that does happen, too, is when you look at all the 16 topics he's done so far, in the same way that a certain light is shed on these topics, and those topics become an agenda item. It's something that people become interested in. So I see television histories as a good thing, because it introduces people to the topics, and what it leads some of these viewers to do is to be aware of things they wouldn't before and to investigate deeper into these historical subjects, which is a very good thing for them to do.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Edgerton.
Now, I'm pleased to be with you, Eileen.
We have been talking with Dr. Gary Edgerton, Professor of Communication and Film Studies at Old Dominion University.
In place of our usual site of the week, we've selected a print resource that will provide you with much valuable information on the subject of film and history. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
If you are interested in learning more about film and history, you should take a look at the summer 2003 issue of the Magazine of History, published by the Organization of American Historians. In that issue, you will find essays on the value of film in teaching and learning history by noted historians, articles on Ken Burns's work in particular, a list of other resources available to you on film and history, and, for teachers, lesson plans on using film to teach history. There is a little bit for everyone interested in the subject in the summer 2003 issue of the Magazine of History, available from the Organization of American Historians. To get a copy, visit the organization's website at oah.org.
And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. Paul Buell, Senior Lecturer in History and American Studies at Brown University, tells us why it's important to study comics in order to better understand American culture and society, past and present.
Where did they come from? They're after me.
There he goes!
That was close.
Comics are an intimate part of our last 100 years.
Spider-Man, like Superman, Batman, the Phantom, Wonder Woman, the Hulk, and other superheroes transferred from newspaper funny pages and comic books to film and television, remind us that form-fitting costumes and secret double identities never really go out of fashion. Mad Magazine, the most famous and popular of American humor publications, has educated generations to mistrust slogans of all kinds. The so-called underground comics of the 1970s, drawn by Robert Crumb, Bill Griffith of the daily strip Zippy, Art Spiegelman of the Holocaust novel Mouse, and others introduced the forbidden subjects of sex, drugs, and human rights tragedies, now likely to be viewed by millions and drawn by hundreds or perhaps thousands of lesser-known artists on any given day in the Internet. Yet American intellectuals until very recently have continued the old bad habit of not taking comics seriously. History and English professors, art critics, and others looked upon them as unworthy of investigation. Worse, perhaps, most of the artists, unless they were lucky enough to have a daily comic strip in major newspapers, thought of their own careers as a poor substitute for better-paying jobs in commercial art, especially advertising. Not even the huge successes of Roy Lichtenstein and Andy Warhol, transforming comic strips into modern art icons, changed the comic's reputation. In contrast to other parts of the globe where millions of adults read graphic novels, American readers and booksellers have barely begun to accept them. If things are at last changing, it is partly because intellectuals and artists in middle age, such as myself, seem to be re-examining our own collective childhoods of the 1940s to the 1960s, from the Second World War to the Vietnam War, with everything in between. The award-winning new film American Splendor is the story of comic script writer Harvey Pekar, as his comics have always been about his own adult life, and that also should tell us something. We want to know why comics were the very first books that we collected and studied. We want to understand the role of a humble narrative art that may be simplistic in plot and dialogue, but is usually more idealistic than non-fiction stories in the news, and sometimes more insightful. In short, we are trying to figure out why our comic heroes, superheroic or just plain funny, stay with us when so much else that we learned in school and elsewhere has been discredited or forgotten. Thanks to some new good books, to specialized magazines, and to a more lively public discussion of comic art, we finally seem to be getting somewhere.
You've been listening to Paul Buell, senior lecturer at Brown University. Buell is the author of Hide in Plain Sight, The Hollywood Blacklistees in Film and Television 1950 to 2002. He's currently working on a comic book format history of the industrial workers of the world. And that wraps up another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments and suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History, visit our website at oah.org. And until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.